Welcome to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, where we bring you news, politics, and culture without the red and blue treatment. My name is Bob Schlehuber. I'm here with my co-host, Michelle Witte. Get ready to go against the grain. It's Monday, November 30th. We're on 105.5 FM in the nation's capital. We're streaming online around the world, wherever you are. Thank you for listening. We have a big show for you today. We have more Joe Biden cabinet picks, including Neera Tanden at the Office of Management and Budget. She'll be overseeing the U.S. budget. Quite a bit of foreign policy news out there today to check in on as well, including continued fighting in Ethiopia between government forces and the Northern Tigray People's Liberation Front. And later in the show, a top Iranian scientist is assassinated in Iran as Jared Kushner just happens to be traveling to Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Michelle, everyone was asking, what will Jared and Ivanka do when they leave the White House? Where will they live? Who will they hang out with? And their answer, Michelle, they aren't done at the White House, so don't worry about it. How does it feel?
Bob, in case you'd forgotten, they don't actually live at the White House, and they have announced that they are moving to New Jersey. And I'm seeing here that you are expecting me to say that that feels fine. But as you might recall, I've been asking for everyone who's on Jared and Ivanka, where will they live? Watch to take a break. And so I don't feel fine that it's just Monday and you're already ignoring what I've asked.
Maybe they'll move to Saudi Arabia.
That would be absolutely delightful, Bob. You've redeemed yourself already in my eyes. So, Bob, how was your Thanksgiving holiday? Did you spend time with your family?
You know, actually, Michelle, with the whole COVID thing, and I'm calling it a thing, the global pandemic, I decided to stay here in D.C., far, far from my family in Rockford, Illinois.
Well, Bob, you know, you were not alone in that decision. And it's not just because no one wants to go to Rockford, Illinois. I want to take a minute and push back a little bit on all of the headlines and all of the shouting last week about how, oh my God, all these awful people are traveling and they're the reason we can't have nice things. All of this shaming, all of these numbers without any context. And talk about what actually did happen over Thanksgiving weekend, because now we know. TSA spokesperson Lisa Farbstein has been posting these figures to Twitter as they come out, on the days of the holiday weekend. And so, yeah, Bob, while some people still did travel around Thanksgiving, they did so in much, much smaller numbers than in usual years. On Thanksgiving Day, which is not usually a very heavy travel day, but we had about a third as many people moving through American airports on Thanksgiving Day 2020 as they did last year. Fewer than half as many people were traveling the Wednesday before Thanksgiving as they did in 2019, which is a very big travel day. And far fewer than half as many people were flying yesterday as they were the year before. Yesterday, it's like almost a third. It's a little more than a third. So all of these stories about millions of people traveling ignore the fact that many more people chose not to. And that is really clear. Far more people chose not to travel over this holiday for whatever reason, probably mostly because of the pandemic, because they were asked not to. And so, you know, good for them. And I want to make sure that we all see this and realize it, because I do think the ultimate effect of these breathless articles about these pandemic meanies ruining it for everybody by going to see grandma ultimately, as a whole, serve to obscure the real culprits here, who are, again, our federal, state, and local governments insisting that we can't find any more aid money for people and that it's fine for businesses to stay open, including, of course, airlines, including hotels, and saying, look, everybody, business has to continue as normal. And the only way to stop the spread of this virus is for you to cut back on your social lives that don't make us any money, except, of course, for going to restaurants, because you have to do that or else the restaurants will all close and it'll be your fault as individuals, right? This is really mixed messaging. And I do think, like, focusing on people who are not doing what we would want them to do instead of all the people who are really just sort of adds fuel to the fires of these people who want to say that the fact this pandemic continues to spread across this country is the fault of individuals and not policymakers, because that is not true. So here's your friendly reminder. It's their fault. But with that said, Bob, What did you find to do in this fair city where the rain appears to have stopped for a minute?
Just for a minute, the rain has stopped. I mean, over the weekend, you know, I did take interest and I found plenty to do. I took interest in two older men here in DC that I've hung out with over the holiday the last few years. The men are in their mid to late 70s and both have high stress jobs and need some extra care with their pretty hard work. So I was there for them. Plus, they actually have jobs where their families are always, always around and heavily involved in all the nepotism. I mean, sorry, not almost a nepotism there. Sorry, I mean in their day-to-day affairs. So we all hung out. It was great.
Wow. So, Bob, you had two septuagenarians working hard over a holiday weekend. Actually, that sounds like the American way. So I'm sure everything went fine. Did it?
Yeah, things were not so great. One of the men had kind of a public meltdown on Fox News. Nothing new for him, but each time it never feels great. And the other had a pretty productive work weekend, pushing a lot of paper, but actually ended up breaking his foot while playing with his dog, Michelle.
Bob, was the dog's name by any chance Major? Bob, are you pretending that you did some kind of Boys and Girls Club thing, except for the olds, but you're talking about Donald Trump and Joe Biden? Because I don't think following the news over the weekend counts as hanging out with Donnie and Joey.
Are you kidding me? Don, Joe, Bob, the three-letter name club? It's actually an old U.S. party trick. If you walk into a room and don't know anyone, you yell out, Don, Joe, Bob, and you'll instantly draw two to three old men towards you. Not really sure why anyone would do this trick, but it works, Michelle. We're good buddies.
All right. I'm going to have to try that for just a variety of reasons, Bob. Anyway, tell us more about your hangouts with the guys.
Sure. Well, Don, as you know, has been struggling lately in general. He just had a big performance review where 65% of the American people gave him a thumbs up or thumbs down. The thumbs down took it to a tune of just over 80 million to just under 74 million for the thumbs up. And while a lot of people counted and recounted the votes, Don is just not accepting the results. Have a listen to him here on Fox News.
We won the election easily. There's no way Joe Biden got 80 million votes. I just said there's no way Joe Biden beat Barack Obama in the black communities of various cities. And then he did very badly compared to Obama in other cities throughout the United States. There's no way it happened.
This
election was a fraud. It was a rigged election.
Okay, Bob, I don't know. I feel like your charge, your 70-year-old best buddy, is not doing well at all. Again, Bob, listening to Donald Trump do a phone interview with Maria Bartiromo on Fox News for the first time since the election, again, I don't feel like it counts as hanging out. And if it did count as hanging out, Bob, your buddy's not doing as well as he's supposed to be in your care.
Best friends. Anyways, it's my story, Michelle. Things got worse for the Don over the weekend. Don, as we reported, paid $3 million to recount the presidential vote in the state of Wisconsin. The result, Joe Biden extended his lead in the state by 87 votes. Don spun the news saying the Wisconsin recount is not about finding mistakes in the count. It is about finding people who have voted illegally. And that case will be brought after the recount is over on Monday or Tuesday.
Okay, well then, Bob, I myself can't wait to hang out with Donald Trump today and tomorrow to hear more about fake voter fraud that never actually happened. And since you guys are so close and I'm just going to be hanging out with him for the first time in this way, maybe you should talk him down. Maybe you can get him to give up the hunt while you guys are on your really friendly, first name basis kind of hangout.
See, I would do that, Michelle, but the problem is he has too many enablers hanging out with them, like the aforementioned Bartiromo. And these folks love rooting on some unhinged Trump. Have a listen to Bartiromo present some wild math and logic behind how Trump could still win the election, talking directly here to Donald Trump.
If you take out the contested swing states electoral votes, you're back down to President Trump having 232 electoral votes and Joe Biden having 227. That is if you strip out the six states with the legal challenges. So
that's
is
right.
The thinking here that because of the various ballot issues that the Supreme Court will rule that the vote is tainted?
This is just getting into numerology territory, Bob. We're like, look, T and Trump, corresponds to this number of the alphabet. And if you subtract the B in Biden, what you have, if you multiply it by 365, it's beautiful. I mean, it's obviously idiotic, but I do like when things begin to take on a sort of mystical aura. And that is obviously what is happening here. So it sounds like you had your hands full with your buddy Don this weekend. So, Bob, how did you even have time for Joe and Major and all the breaking of bones?
Yeah, you know, Michelle, it was hectic. And you know what? I turned away from Joe for 1 second and boom, his dog Major trips him up while playing. And the next thing you know, Joe broke his right foot. He'll be walking around in a boot for the next several weeks.
Again, Bob, I really feel like we need to make it clear for our listeners that you are talking about Joe Biden, president-elect of the United States, not Joe, an old man you met across the street raking leaves or something.
Oh, yeah. All right. Fine, Michelle. Easy. But Joe Biden is going to live 2.5 miles from me. And given the propensity for older men to wander, I could end up being his actual friend. But yes, yes, I am talking about Joe Biden and not someone I actually met this weekend. Anyways, Joe was still able to have a very busy weekend despite the foot. Biden announced several more administration nominees and appointees over the weekend. Gaining the most backlash was his announcement that internet troll and president of the think tank Center for American Progress, Neera Tanden, would be his nominee to be director of the Office of Management and Budget. OMB, more like OMG.
Wow. Okay,
anyway, so people had the same response to Tannen's nomination, and they are upset. We'll be joined by John Jeter and Kay Pritzker to talk more about Tannen in just a few minutes. Joining the Economic Brain Trust along with Tannen does also include Janet Yellen at Treasury, along with Cecilia Roos, a Princeton University labor economist who will chair the Council of Economic Advisors. Wally Adeyemo, a former senior international economic advisor during the Obama administration, will serve as Yellen's top deputy at the Treasury Department. Jared Bernstein and Heather Boucher will serve as members of the CEA alongside Ms. Roos. Brian Deese, a former senior Obama administration official and an executive at the investment bank BlackRock, which we'll also talk about here in a few minutes, will head the National Economic Council. On Sunday, Biden also announced his White House senior communication team that includes Jen Psaki, the former Obama White House communications director, and his incoming White House press secretary, Kate Benningfield, as a communications director. And Simone Sanders, thank God, will be out of the Oval Office. She'll be serving as a senior advisor and chief spokesman for Kamala Harris.
I did look up specifically what exactly Simone Sanders was going to do because I wanted to know, because that betrayal feels a little bit personal, Bob. And I feel like we should take this moment here at the top of the show to just raise a glass to all the folks, we all know them, who are able to say with a straight face that there is no Democratic establishment. I mean, that's a level of shamelessness, Bob, that I think we can all aspire to.
Something to aspire to here on a rainy Monday. Michelle, we got a big show up ahead. Let's take our first break of the hour. In the first hour, we will be talking about the reactions to Biden's latest administration picks, how Democrats continue to market neoliberalism to the American people. And later in the hour, we head to Ethiopia as fighting continues in the Northern Tigray region. And if that's not enough, don't you worry, Misfits. We have a second hour for you after that. You're listening to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, live in D.C. We're back after this. Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, where we bring you news, politics, and culture without the red and blue treatment. Got a good show here for you today. Some big headlines out there catching our attention, including the brazen assassination of an Iranian scientist in Iran and continued fighting in Ethiopia. But first, we stay domestically to talk about the response to Joe Biden's latest cabinet nominees. If you have any thoughts on the team, and that could be the foreign policy, communications, economic teams announced there, in Biden's cabinet and administration, shoot us a message at Sputnik Misfits on Twitter or Instagram, or you can give us a call 202-521-1320. That's 202-521-1320. We're joined now to talk about Biden's economic and communications teams by John Jeter, an author and award-winning foreign correspondent, former Washington Post bureau chief, as well as a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, and Kay Pritzker, journalist with Breakthrough News. John and Kay, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
John, thanks for being back with us. Let me start here with Neera Tanden as director of the Office of Management and Budget. Tanden seems to irk both progressives and conservatives in similar ways. Breonna Joy Gray, the former press secretary for Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign, called Tanden, quote, a woman who is openly disdainful of Bernie Sanders and his coalition, but who is friendly with extreme bigots online, and tweeted, everything toxic about the corporate Democratic Party is embodied in Neera Tanden. And on the GOP side of things, Senator John Cornyn of Texas said Tanden stands zero chance of being confirmed. John, I'm curious your reaction to Tanden's nomination.
Well, I think, you know, the thing that strikes me most is not so much Neera Tanden's nomination. I rather expected that. But I'm really shocked. No, I take that back. I'm not shocked. I think it's very telling that Bernie Sanders is not in the mix anywhere. I think it says that Biden plans to stay the course economically, and that course is a neoliberal one that is capitalism on steroids, and Tanden is part of that ship that is guiding us into an iceberg. Tanden doesn't, she doesn't surprise me, but I think it's very telling, her nomination.
Yeah, it's funny too, John, with you, like, all right, for every eight or nine appointments or nominees, how about one progressive? Like, what's the trade-off going to be? Because it seems so far it's about 100% neoliberal establishment Democrats having worked for the Clinton Foundation or the Obama administration.
Yeah, and it's you know, pardon me, I think I've told this story before, but it reminds me of the Enron's failure when that company was sort of discovered to be a fraud, and there was a young reporter for Fortune magazine, I believe it was, or Forbes magazine, I can't remember which, but they were having a party, sort of an online a phone call where all these business reporters were celebrating the latest profits, you know, which were you know, rigged profits with Enron, and this young reporter, I can't remember her name, Bethany McLean, I think, she interrupts this sort of cheering, and she says, I'm sorry, can you explain to me how you make your money again? And that was the beginning of the fall of Enron. And I feel like we're in the same place. We need to ask our political class, how do we make our money? And the answer is we print it, right? I mean, that's what we are right now. We don't actually create any wealth. And so Biden's picks for his economic team signals to us very clearly he's going to continue that policy, which, of course, is going to kill all of us.
All right. Well, that's a good summary there from John Jeter. Kay Pritzker, I think you'll probably agree with mostly what John said. You know, for me, this embodies the smugness of liberal Democrats. You know, I feel like having progressives and conservatives both dislike Tanden only emboldens the center to think that they are the pragmatic, realist, compromiser adults in the rooms. But let me just share two quick stories about Neera Tanden. The first story, a short one, Tannen's response to David Sirota, a left-leaning journalist, about a year and a half ago. During the campaign, Sirota found that liberal darling Beto O'Rourke was the number two recipient of oil gas industry campaign cash in the entire Congress. And Neera Tanden quickly pushed back, tweeting, oh, look, a supporter of Bernie Sanders attacking a Democrat. This is seriously dangerous because no internal disagreements can be aired in the public, and shaming party members who take oil money is bad for the brand. And the second story, Kay, in 2015, Tanden gained quite a bit of pushback by staff and progressives for booking a speaking engagement for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the Center for American Progress CAP in 2015. In response, Tanden sent an email on the day of the Netanyahu visit to CAP founder John Podesta that the far left hates me for hosting Mr. Netanyahu, but the invitation may have sealed the deal with a new board member. Ms. Tanden was at the time wooing Jonathan Levine, a managing partner at Bain Capital and a pro-Israeli philanthropist. The next month, Tanden writes a jubilant email to Mike Podesta telling him Mr. Levine was joining the board. So Netanyahu was worth it, she said, with a smiley face emoji. Levine no longer sits on the center's board, but his foundation remains a big donor. Despite the leaked emails now that we got through WikiLeaks showing the end goal of the BB visit was a CAP spokes end goal of the Bibi visit was to gain this donor. A CAP spokesman said of the allegations, the Netanyahu event was arranged with public and private support of the Obama administration, and the notion that it was done at the behest of any donor is preposterous. So their spokesperson, they're basically lying about what we have in those emails. Kay, I mean, they're smug liars. I don't know else to describe Neera Tanen but that when you see the paper trail that follows.
Yeah, I think that makes her a great pick for the Biden administration. Just the flip-flopping, the total lack of principles, you know, being an ardent supporter of Israeli apartheid, finance capital, I think she fits just in line with the Biden administration. And yeah, I mean, people have been, she's been such an enemy to the progressive movement. I mean, she doesn't really hide it, but she's been, you know, one of the main people pushing this narrative that progressives are ruining the Democratic Party and that progressive policies are unpopular. And of course, you know, the irony, I think, is that it was people like Neera Tanen who probably are responsible for Trump winning the 2016 election. I mean, she was so much quicker to blame Russia. And, she, you know, she blamed all these people for being Russian agents for supporting Bernie Sanders or pointing out, like you said, flaws in the Democratic Party or bad policies, that, you know, there's no critical evaluation. There's no self-evaluation of what actually tanked the Clinton campaign in 2016, which was obviously, you know, very unexciting candidate that a lot of people hate, and someone who was offering no vision besides I'm not Donald Trump. So, yeah, you know, I think Neera Tanen fits right in. And of course, you know, she's of the same ilk. She's of the same sort of political class, this, you know, urban elite liberal class that's in with the Clinton family and the Bidens, I guess, and the Obama White House. So, you know, the message from the Biden administration is no change. You know, everything they were telling us, really, we're just going to please the Warren people. We just want to please the Sanders people. But, you know, now we're in the White House. Shut up. We're going to do our own thing.
Yeah. And if you want to just see the smugness on full display, if you go back to that 2016 platform committee debate, Jim Zogby, Matt Duss, Cornel West, and others along with Neera Tanen, and just to watch how just absolutely annoyed she is listening to Cornel West talk about the rights of the Palestinian people and that we should have equal respect for people around the world, despite regardless of where they're born, is just like could not be bothered to be there making the rules for the Democratic Party. How dare she have to be sequestered to this public hearing? Yeah, it was a lot. But John, I want to slowly pull back to the larger picture here. Let me read from the New York Times from a piece in April of 2019 regarding donors to Tanen's Center for American Progress. It reads, quote, donors' roles overlap substantially with those of the Clinton's campaigns and foundation. The think tank has taken in millions from interest, often criticized by liberals, including Wall Street financiers, big banks, Silicon Valley titans, foreign governments, defense contractors, and the healthcare industry. Individual donors can ask to remain anonymous. Money to the Center for American Progress from the personal foundation of Facebook creator Mark Zuckerberg surged to $665,000 in 2018. The center also got $1 million from the Family Foundation of Jonathan Levine and at least $1 million from the tech industry's Silicon Valley Community Foundation. CAP also received $225,000 from the private foundation of the Walmart heir, Sam Walton. John, let me throw in Brian Deese, who is the head, will be, if confirmed here, the head of the National Economic Council, and Wally Adeyemo, who is Yellen's top deputy at Treasury. Both Adeyemo and Deese have both worked at BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager. John, as Michelle said at the end of our opening there, I mean, just amazing people say with a straight face there is no Democratic establishment. I mean, what do these people and their deep ties to corporate America mean for everyday Americans?
Yeah, you know, it's troubling. It really is. And I don't think the media, current company excluded, of course, the media really does a great disservice to the people, to the American people, by not explaining to them exactly what's going on. And this is a coup d'etat, right? So if you have people, a majority of people, and sometimes as much as 80%, according to some polls, which want Medicare for all and have wanted it for nearly 40 years now, consistently in the polls, overwhelmingly in the polls, and you don't have it, well, do you really have a democracy? And, you know, we don't have it because of institutions like BlackRock and their collusion with the political class. I won't use the F word because it's often debated what fascism truly is. But there is a seamlessness between our politicians, our elected representatives, and the investment bankers like BlackRock, and their interests are in lockstep with one another. And we, the people, get screwed in that. And so what we have right now at this moment is, you know, I'm not sure that capitalism can fix the crisis that we're in terms of the pandemic, which requires some real investment in healthcare, and particularly investment in healthcare for poor and working people and people of color. And requires a real kind of Keynesian approach to investing in the economy and in development. And I'm not sure that even at this point will fix things. But at the very least, we need to see that. And what Blackstone represents is a firm no. We're not going to see that. We're not going to see these things for the people. You know, look, this is what's happened, right? Since the Reagan administration, since I was a teenager and Ronald Reagan was elected, you know, we've had an industrial economy that we've hollowed out under the notion that capital can extract wealth without producing wealth. Well, you don't have to be an economist to understand that's ridiculous. It's absurd, right? People's wages, right, are what is capital's rent and mortgages and credit card payments and college loan payments. And if we don't have those wages, and the pandemic has made that painfully, that contradiction very painfully clear, if we don't have those wages, then the entire economy suffers. And that's what we're not hearing from the media. To explain, the media is not explaining this predicament. And so we continue to sort of double down on these policies. You know, I loathe Donald Trump with the best of them, but Donald Trump was not the problem. The problem, and if you want to talk about conspiracies, people talk about the conspiracy of the pandemic and the conspiracy of the election. If you really want to talk about the conspiracy happened 12 years ago when Wall Street bundled all of these toxic mortgages that they sold disproportionately to Black people, swindle people out of their homes, and the Obama administration, following the Bush administration, paid them to do this and to do it again. That's the conspiracy, and that's the one that's going to destroy the American economy.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. I mean, Kay, for me, I mean, we've talked a lot about the show about whether or not there would be some type of economic or social movement. For me, it would come sometime next year, at kind of Occupy Wall Street-esque protest movement around the economy. And it's just like Joe Biden's basically challenging everybody, saying, bring it on. I'm not even going to pretend that we're not going to fund and support Wall Street within my administration.
Yeah, it is actually stunning how many people in the Biden cabinet being considered for the Biden cabinet. A lot of their qualifications are like, I work for venture capital, or I work for a venture capital firm. It's like, what kind of qualification is that to run the government? But obviously, from the perspective of a system that puts profit above everything, it makes perfect sense. I mean, those are the people ultimately that this system serves, people who invest money to make a profit off of that investment and do nothing actually valuable or contribute anything to the real economy. So, yeah, you know, Biden said this much. There were all the gaffes and the leaked comments saying, you know, he doesn't care about making any progressive platform points. I mean, there were people holding out for some kind of Bernie Sanders aligned cabinet pick, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. I mean, there's still some up in the air, but from what we've seen so far, that it clearly he's going the opposite direction. And, you know, again, this is not a surprise. You know, Joe Biden was not going to overcome the pandemic. Getting, you know, this isn't a consequence of the Donald Trump presidency. This is a consequence of a system that puts profit before people. I mean, Joe Biden's not going to pay people to stay home. He's not going to cancel rent and mortgages. He's not going to do what is necessary, make these sort of radical changes to our economy that's necessary to, you know, overcome this pandemic. So you know, they're saying that, I mean, millions of people are going to be facing eviction in the coming months. Millions of people are going to, you know, are struggling with healthcare, and the government's not doing anything to support people's medical payments or anything like that. And, yeah, you know, Joe Biden isn't about to change any of that. So it really is up to the movement. It really is up to people to force the hand of the Biden administration.
Yeah, I guess we all just we'll have to eat our words when Bernie Sanders gets named labor secretary here in a few days. Uh-huh. But I do not think that's going to happen, which, Michelle, would be kind of like, what exactly was Bernie Sanders' negotiation to drop out and support Joe Biden? If it might just literally have ended up being he did not want to be the foil or cause Joe Biden to lose to Donald Trump. And that might be all. I mean, some of us thought he would at least negotiate, get a position or get some of these nominees or different cabinet positions for progressives, but that has not panned out. But Michelle, I wanted to get your thoughts on Sunday. The other big announcement this weekend, apart from the economic rollout, was the White House senior communications team. It's an all-female, reminded by all of the media, it's an all-female seven-member group that includes Jen Psaki, a former Obama White House communications director, as his incoming White House press secretary, Kate Bedingfield as his communications director, Karine Jean-Pierre has been named as principal deputy press secretary in the White House, and Philly Tobar will be the deputy White House communications director. Michelle, the media seemed the last few days to be very, very focused on the comms team's race, gender, and sexuality, and not so much on what exactly these folks will be communicating to the American people.
No, I mean, that's always the case, right? It's always the messenger and never the message, really, when it comes to a Biden and the Democratic Party. So, yeah, I mean, I think one, like, I'm not going to say that representation doesn't matter at all. And so, cool. It's cool to see women in positions of power. I mean, we've had women in positions of power already. I don't personally feel particularly motivated or thrilled by Biden's all-female communications team. I mean, it's also funny because it's communication. So it's like one of the softer aspects of the administration. So, oh, cool. It's like, your whole nursing staff is ladies. Beautiful. But the fact also that it's like a huge celebration that you got all of these women flanking, you know, once again, the sort of center of the government, who is an old white dude. And you just look around the rest of the world and see, you know, in some of our peer nations, the roles that women play and the roles of people of very different ages play. And you will see how absolutely backward we are in the U.S. And it doesn't have anything to do with gender. I mean, it has to do with money. And it has to do with, you know, all of the things that you guys have been talking about for the past segment, who you play the game with and how you play it and what you're willing to do and not do. So I'm not at all surprised that this is being heralded as a huge celebration. I'm not at all surprised that it's being somehow sold to us as a breath of fresh air, even though I think almost every single one of Biden's major picks is a former Obama staffer. So the idea that these people are coming in, bringing like new ideas that are really going to change things is laughable. And these are also the people who, you know, brought us as John referenced to the recovery to the 2008 crisis, which wasn't good. So I don't think there is a ton to be excited about here. And the fact that they're all women is just the fact that they're focusing on that means they just don't have anything. That's the only thing they can latch onto that seems real.
Yeah. And I think with identity politics, for me, when you have something important to say, I think it matters who says it. And I think that's when we can think about if it's an economic movement, I think it should be led by people that are workers. That does matter. But we have nothing to say, John, when you're coming back out with old policies from old administrations. At that point, it doesn't matter who says it. It's all garbage. And I think what the Biden administration is, what Michelle's saying, is they're trying to roll out these fresh faces, young women, very camera, photogenic, ready to come out there. But they're selling us the same failed policies of the past. I mean, I guess it works for the American people for a little while. But how do you think they'll keep it fresh enough? Or are they just going to basically run themselves tired after a few months in office and people will realize that it's the Obama administration that was kicked out via Hillary Clinton's loss that's now just back in office?
Yeah, I they're trying to put the genie back in the bottle. And my suspicion is that Biden, in an attempt to to keep white men within the Democratic Party, or to return white men to the Democratic Party, I guess, depending on how you look at 2016, that he will veer right, and that he, you know, I think that's why we haven't seen it, like Susan Rice, for instance, in a high-profile position like Secretary of State. He wants to reassure the white men that, you know, things are going to remain the same, and they can't, right? I mean, we've crossed the Rubicon at this point, right? And so I think this is a desperate attempt to keep things, to reassure the average white male voter. And I think it's going to fail because, you know, we are going to see some evictions later next month, late next month, and beginning late next month. We are going to see jobs that won't return. We are seeing already this rebellion all across the world against the United States and the hegemony of the United States dollar. And so this is all sort of desperation. I wish the media would really kind of, you know, lay out the battle that's being fought, you know, because people are dying and they will die. And I mean that literally in terms of the pandemic, certainly. But there's just not. This is a class war, and the class war is a battle over truths, right? Well, we're not getting either truth out there, right? We've got an alibi, right, which is false, and then the other side is completely silenced. And you know, Bernie Sanders' sort of exclusion, and I think Bernie Sanders has to take a lot of the blame himself, right? He is sort of sacrificed himself on the altar of the Democratic Party. But it's not about him. It's about the American people and some very real suffering. And we're not going to get out of this until people start to understand what has happened. And that Barack Obama, in terms of his policies, you know, he might have been better looking. He might be better spoken. But his policies are the same. Virtually indistinguishable, with one exception, which is that Donald Trump, for all his flaws, and they are many, he did not enter into any new wars. And Joe Biden, I'm guessing that sometime by Independence Day of next year, Joe Biden will have us in another war.
Yeah, I mean, Trump still has another 50 days in office to stir things up there with Iran, but I hope you are right on the no new war angle there. Kay, speaking of Barack Obama, I believe you recently had the opportunity to read Barack Obama's new memoir, A Promised Land. I think you did it to make some jokes at the expense of Obama and the framing by his administration and his time in office, not out of enjoyment on your weekend off there. But I'm curious what you made of the book and how you think neoliberals and this new communications team in, how do they spin things? How do they present things? How do they get so many American people to come back? 80 million plus people came back to vote for the continuation of the Democratic Party in the White House.
Yeah, it's a very generous use of the word opportunity, but I did read the book, and you know, I would say that it really is meant to sort of, I guess, you know, frame the world and frame the last 4 years as this sort of, what's the word, as an outlier point, and that everything was sort of fine and rational under the Obama administration. Of course, a lot of the book is apologizing and sort of rationalizing all of the controversial period during the Obama administration. Certainly the Libya intervention, he spends like 15 pages talking about how this was such a, you know, he really didn't want to do it. And, you know, there were all these complicated factors, but finally he picked the right policy, not to do a no-fly zone, but to shoot cruise missiles at Tripoli. There are a lot of things like that. Of course, it also does leave out the Edward Snowden leaks. That's not mentioned in the book at all. Never brings up Chelsea Manning's leaks either. But yeah, you know, a lot of justification is provided. It's sort of ahistorical, and he's sort of, you know, rewriting his own history. And at the same time, it is this, you know, this defense of the status quo to say that everything, you know, was sort of on track. Everything was, you know, the world had rules and it had a sort of a method to the madness. And then Donald Trump came and eroded all of that. So, you know, I think that's exactly what I would do if I was Obama. You know, I think that's what a lot of people do with their sort of memoirs, is they try to highlight the best parts and explain away the worst parts.
Yeah, it's always funny. It's like kind of Donald Trump too. Like the economy was doing great if it wasn't for the coronavirus, and outside of the Libyan war failing and there being now open air slave markets, everything was great except a few things that went bad along the way. So remarkable there to watch this communications team move back into the White House. That was John Jeter, an author and award-winning foreign correspondent, and Kay Pritzker, a journalist with Breakthrough News. You can see more of Breakthrough News at BT Newsroom there on social media. John and Kay, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
With that, we take a quick break before heading to Ethiopia, where fighting continues in the north of the country. You're listening to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, live in D.C. We're back after this. Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, where we bring you news, politics, and culture without the red and blue treatment. I'm Bob Schlehuber here with Michelle Witte. We head now to Ethiopia, where the army has announced that they have gained full control of the capital of the defiant Tigray region. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said the taking of Mekelle marked the completion of an offense that started nearly 4 weeks ago. The regional Tigray government said the city of 500,000 people was heavily bombarded in the final push to arrest the leaders of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Army. Now, Abe said police will pursue the leaders of TPLF as they head to the north. Joining us now to talk about the recent developments and the future of the conflict in the Horn of Africa is journalist and senior East African political analyst Marchette Demissi and Professor Hakim Adi, professor of the history of Africa and the African diaspora at the University of Chichester. Marchette, let me start with you. Thank you for joining us. You are in Ethiopia, where Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed spoke this morning, responding to questions raised by members of the House of People's Representatives. I'm curious, what did Abiy say to the nation today?
Hello, everyone. I'm Marchette from Ethiopia, and Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed was mentioned today in the House of People representative office about the current TPLF and Tigray region conditions and the total Ethiopian national sovereignty. So the TPLF, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said the TPLF group have been working to create conflicts in different localities of Ethiopia, especially in Amhara regional head. For instance, why the peoples of Gondolive, Harmony, these all nations are tied together, other peoples through marriage. Then the TPLF have been investigated clash by dividing the peoples of Gondar in different political views by race. The Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed in his reports that the HPR or House of People representatives face in the last 2.5 years. There have been 37 clashes in another Oromia region where many Amhara and other ethnic groups have been killed in the negative attitudes and logistic support of the Tigrayan Liberation Front, the so-called TPLF, were pushed into conflict. Besides, TPLF was working to make Oromia a hotspot violence, and the Prime Minister explained to members of the House of People representatives that similar conflicts sponsored by TPLF have taken place in Amhara regions within the peoples of Gondar. There are many nations in Tigray, but there is no conflict. It happens because leaders of TPLF are in Tigray, provoking clashes into another areas of the country. Not only that, the TPLF has been asking the Sudan government troops to make whatever borders they want. So the Prime Minister said we have the piece of evidence that the Sudan forces had reacted that they would not have taken the land illegally. So totally, the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed today mentioned about the Tigrayan people and the TPLF linkages about the past years in the country and the besides what another Ethiopian was colonized for the past 30 years because they are dictators. Today, the military campus was participating to find different graves around the northern parts of Amhara region in the neighbors of the Tigray region. also around the airport, around the Gondar Pass, there have been mass graves today around 6 o'clock. Then now the Tigray region, there is a conflict and a war between the Ethiopian military force and the TPLF military forces. In this war, the government controls Mekelle for the past days, especially the past 10 days, previously, And during this time, the TPLF leaders have been frustrated because their demos have been strengthened within the military forces of Ethiopia. And as I mentioned yesterday for you, this conflict have two main causes. That means the pretext cause and the immediate cause. The pretext cause is the TPLF breaks the national sovereignty of Ethiopia by attacking the northern military camp.
Yeah. Marsha, let me just put a pin in it there real quick. Let me go here to Professor Adia. Professor, let me bring you in. Thank you for being with us. I want to take a few steps back there as we hear what Abiy had to say today to the parliament. I want to go back to Friday and the African Union's involvement in the conflict there in Ethiopia. You know, the AU sent a delegation on Friday to the country consisting of former presidents of Liberia, South Africa, and Mozambique, but were told by Abiy's government that they would continue its military operations. Abiy said he appreciated the AU envoy's elderly concern, but told him that his government's failure to enforce the rule of law in Tigray would nurture a culture of impunity with devastating costs to the survival of the country. I'm curious, Professor Adi, what did you make of Abiy turning away the African Union and the events that unfolded over the weekend?
Well, it seems to me very strange that, as far as I understand it, the president of Ethiopia made a commitment with the African Union that a mediation team should be utilized. So it seems rather strange that the Ethiopia's prime minister should then snub that delegation. I mean, I think the other rather strange thing is that this is termed a law enforcement operation. I'm not sure if the people of most countries would be willing to have the army of the country engaged in bombing and attacking towns and cities in order to conduct law enforcement. So it doesn't seem to me very much like a law enforcement operation. It seems very much to me like a military conflict, a civil war is taking place within Ethiopia. And it's rather difficult to understand how different interpretations of the constitution, which seems to be the main point at issue, can result in the government of a country declaring war on one of its regions. The constitution very clearly defines the rights of nations and the rights of regional national states. And so it's difficult to see why the government of Ethiopia, let alone a government headed by somebody who was awarded a peace prize, is making war on his own people.
Yeah, and I guess the question now is how deep will that war be there in the north while they've taken the capital there of the Tigray region? It seems like they're now on a manhunt for the leaders of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. But the problem, I guess, for the Ethiopian government is this is the type of fight that the TPLF has sustained in the past, and they do know how to do a guerrilla warfare. So I'm curious what it now looks like for the Ethiopian government with its troops up in the northern region, I guess, chasing these leaders away from the capital.
Well, I think, the other question is that what's happening? We don't actually know what's happening because the Ethiopian government are preventing anybody seeing what's happening. As you said, they're preventing the AU from accessing the region. They're preventing journalists and media from accessing the region. There's no evidence that anything that the Ethiopian government says is actually happening. I think the other rather worrying problem is not just what's going on within Ethiopia, where, of course, there have been violent incidents in other parts of the country, not just in the north in Tigray, but also in Oromia and in the southern region of Ethiopia. But also there appears to be the involvement of other governments, particularly the government of Eritrea. And there are also reports that the government of the UAE are involved in supplying drones and other material to the Ethiopian government. So it's already become rather an international conflict with, we're also hearing reports of missiles fired from Tigray into Eritrea. We're hearing reports of the Eritrean refugees who are in the who are in Tigray because of previous difficulties and conflicts, and people fleeing from Eritrea are being conscripted into the Eritrean army, are being moved around by Eritrean government or Ethiopian government. So all kinds of rather alarming reports are coming in. Of course, we don't have the evidence for any of these things. So I think it's a rather worrying situation that other countries are involved. Of course, behind the regional powers are also the, of course, it's an area of contention between the big powers, the US, China, and others. So the potential is for, you know, not only a prolonged conflict, but a rather serious international conflict that could destabilize not just Ethiopia, but the entire region. And as I say, at the heart of it is what kind of Ethiopia should there be? What rights do the people have? Do the people of Ethiopia have the right to elect and be elected? Do the nations, nationalities, and peoples of Ethiopia have the rights which are enshrined in the constitution? And at the moment, the government of Ethiopia seems to be saying, no, they don't have those rights, even though that is what the constitution says. That is what people in Ethiopia have decided. That's what people have even given their lives for. The government of Ethiopia seems to be denying people those rights.
Yeah, and working with Sudan there too to slow the release of people there in the north into Sudan, where they're also facing refugee crisis from the spillover of decades of conflict. Marchette, let me come back to you. Marchette, how are people in Ethiopia responding to the army in the north in Tigray? Are people supportive, or what has been the response of the people there in your country?
The people of Ethiopia have to mentioned their joy, especially after the control of Mekelle town by Ethiopian military force. Especially Addis Ababa people and the eastern and western split of the Hawassa town, Dredewa town, Harar town, Bahadar town, Gondar city, and another locality of Ethiopian people are mentioned their own joy and happiness after the control of Mekelle town by Ethiopian military force. Because all have their own or they tested the bad habits, the bad actions of TPLF for the past years, especially in supported by a different constitutional statement.
Marchette, we just have a few minutes left. I also wanted to ask you a little bit about the work you and others are doing for peace. We talk so much about war and conflict in the country. What is being done to build peace in Ethiopia?
Yeah, to create a good peace for future time in Ethiopia, there are several methods like to handle the TPLF leaders and another separated missionary leaders like OLF or Oromo Liberation Front groups, those who attack another civilians of the western and eastern parts of the country, Ethiopia. Especially, they are working together with TPLF and they are terrorists. So today, the Ethiopian people. Representative council members have asked the state before Prime Minister Abiy, why not the TPLF and OLF be referred in the terrorist groups of the world? So Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed have said we cannot protest referred to groups for and globally for terrorist groups, and they appeal for the Security Council in the United Nations Security Council. So Ethiopia will face in different methodologies currently. Because all people shall peace, shall technology, shall life matter. So the TPLF and the OLF, the two groups especially, attacked the sudden massacre for the past, especially 2 years ago, after the downfall of TPLF members from the central government power, and they become going to Mekelle or the indigenous their localities. The TPLF is interested to again fighting in guerrilla methods against the Ethiopian government. But Ethiopia will fit in the Security Council must be interested in hand to peace in Ethiopia. Christian or civilians must be participated for their peace life in daily activities. And our project strategy is recording every individual by the under the motto of I am the peace one and I am a peace individual, especially by in schools, elementary schools, colleges and universities, politics and communities in marketing areas in a different mode and another transportation and another governmental office or private service sectors to think the people about peace and stability and recording all to be a member of peace people. Then that people, free people methodology is under the motto of I am free from gun and I am free from massacre, I am free from war. So if I will be, if I may be free from gun, me and those who live around me must be free from gun and my child, my sisters, brothers, in our families, in our locality, in our region, and in our country, Ethiopia, must be free from gun. This project basically matters, builds a freedom society for the coming years in Ethiopia and all in Africa.
Yeah. I have to unfortunately cut you out there, Marchette. We are out of time. That was journalist and senior East African political analyst Marchette Demissi and Professor Hakeem Adi, Professor of History of Africa and African Diaspora. Marchette, Professor Adi, thank you so much for joining us. With that, we head to a second hour of news, politics, and culture. In the second hour, we'll be talking about the brazen killing of an Iranian scientist, Jared Kushner's trip to Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and later in the hour, America's Sunday Morning Talk Show's fail to tackle poverty in the U.S. All that and much more. You're listening to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, live in D.C. We're back after this.
Welcome back to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, where we bring you news, politics, and culture without the red and blue treatment. I'm Michelle Witte here with Bob Schlehuber, starting our second hour. And we are, of course, going to hammer the Sunday news shows a little bit later because it is Monday and it is time for our Miss the Press segments a little while in the future, guys, in the future. We are going to talk about Jared Kushner heading to Saudi Arabia. But first, maybe you never noticed it. Maybe you've already forgotten it. But over this holiday weekend, there was another high-profile assassination in Iran, this time one of the country's scientists. So if you want to talk about that or anything else that's coming up, you can call us at 202-521-1320. And yes, this scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, according to Iranian reports, was ambushed and shot while driving about 50 miles outside Tehran, and suspicion immediately fell upon Israel because Israel does conduct targeted killings, as the U.S. does. And Israel has consistently said it will do whatever it takes to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon when it's asked, you know, what are the limits on your engagement here? Nobody in the U.S. or Israel has gone on record saying they were involved, but a few stories in U.S. outlets have off-the-record confirmations, and they also have a lot of assumptions that I want to start breaking down here a little bit. Bob and I are joined by Mitchell Plitnick, political analyst, writer, and president of Rethinking Foreign Policy in this endeavor. So Mitchell, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here again.
Well, Mitchell, Fakhrizadeh is consistently described in these stories about his assassination as the head of Iran's nuclear program. And it is presented as a given that Iran is and always has been actively attempting to build a nuclear weapon. And I'm going to use the New York Times as an example here. In one of its stories the other day, it said, "It remains unclear how much the killing will set back the Iranian program." It also noted that Iran recovered from the assassinations of lower-level scientists and from the cyber attacks from 2007 to 2010 on the nuclear fuel production site at Natanz. That operation set Iran back by a year or so. And so to me, that sounds, one, awfully specific for a program we get so little detail on. And two, like, they're making a lot of assumptions here that I don't know really been confirmed. So can you start us off by clarifying a little bit of what we actually do and don't know about Iran's supposed nuclear weapons program?
Sure. So we actually know for as an established fact, we actually know quite a bit. The Iran nuclear deal of 2015, in that deal, Iran agreed to extremely intrusive International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, inspections. And, I mean, far more than any country has ever agreed to. So we are actually, and incidentally, it's important to note, they've stuck to that part of the agreement despite the United States pulling out. So we know that they are increasing their nuclear stockpile right now. We know the various things, and they've been very open about them, things that they've been doing in response to the United States pulling out. Going farther back, the U.S. and the IAEA both agree and continue to agree that Iran abandoned their nuclear weapon program in 2003. I can't stress that enough. This is U.S. intelligence, and it was a U.S. intelligence assessment that came out in 2003, was confirmed again in 2007. So I think it's important to note that was the George W. Bush administration. That was not an administration that was looking to let Persian Gulf countries off the hook for weapons of mass destruction. They were not looking to ignore such things. They were looking to, they were trying to find them, and as we know, in Iraq, even create evidence of their existence. So that was the administration that concluded that Iran had given up pursuing a nuclear weapon. And even before that, we don't know exactly what their goal was. Many people believe that the that Iran's goal was not to actually acquire a weapon, but to get to breakout capacity, because they're constantly being threatened by the United States and Israel, and they wanted to be at a point which many nations that are non-nuclear and that have no nuclear weapons and have signed the non-proliferation treaty also are at. That's a point many nations, allies and belligerents are also, it's a status they also share. So that's all been going on. Now, Farhad was, in fact, the head of Iran's weapons program. He was a member of the Revolutionary Guard. He was a general in the Revolutionary Guard, which was more, he wasn't really a military leader and strategist. He was, but he had that role in order to head up the weapons program that they had before 2003. And intelligence suggests that he did keep his team together and continued doing lower level nuclear research, for many years, maybe up until his death. But none of that was actually part of a weapons program. Again, all of their nuclear program has been transparent. We know what they're doing. We know they're not pursuing a weapon. We know exactly what the situation is because they continue to allow the IAEA to inspect their sites. What this was not an attempt to forestall an Iranian nuclear weapon. This was an attempt to forestall diplomacy. The point of this assassination was to make it much harder for Joe Biden to reenter the Iran nuclear deal, something we know he wants to do.
So I guess we shouldn't be expecting a retraction from the New York Times or a clarification on this point?
there's actually been a bit of wrangling going on social media with one of the Times writers, David Sanger, who, in my view, wrote a piece that it didn't actually say Iran has a nuclear weapons program, but to somebody who is not not well versed in this issue, it would certainly give that impression that they've had one for years, they continue to have one, and he's been unapologetic. I mean, he's been called out on it by people, very reputable people, in Washington, and he's not backing up.
I mean, I might even sort of gently disagree. I think it just, if you have a sentence that says it remains unclear how much the killing will set back the Iranian program. And you've been talking about a weapons program. I mean, I don't think that's even an insinuation. He's just saying, yeah, I think they're just saying it flat out.
You can certainly read it that way. But, you know, I guess I would just say, you know, they are stopping short of actually saying a weapons program. And you know, we should acknowledge, you know, of course, Iran does have a nuclear program. They need actually nuclear energy because they're net oil. You know, we think that they're oil rich, but in fact, even before the sanctions regime, they were a net oil exporter. So they actually need other sources of energy. And while, you know, from an environmental point of view, many of us can argue whether or not nuclear is the best option or not, you know, they clearly have a civilian reason to pursue nuclear energy. And they do so. And no one disputes that.
No, and of course, people don't go around assassinating the scientists of every country that either makes or purchases low-enriched uranium, you know, that it's just Iran. It feels like this has been a very big year for assassinations. You know, we started off the year with the U.S. killing Qasem Soleimani in Iraq. A couple of weeks ago, we learned about the assassination, apparently, of al-Qaeda's number two in Tehran, which happened back in August. And now, of course, we have this assassination of Fakhrizadeh. And I wonder, or if I want to get you to confirm, is this an unusual amount? And what does these three big assassinations this year tell us about these relationships between the U.S., Iran, and Israel?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure I would say this was an unusual amount. I think it depends. I think it's a fairly, you know, I mean, certainly the magnitude. Someone like Soleimani is a big deal, and also very stupid. You know, there was also al-Baghdadi and last year, and you know, clearly assassinations is something that the Trump administration loves, the Netanyahu government in Israel loves. This is something that they like to do. It is thoroughly illegal under international law. But the fact is, even, you know, sort of centrists and even some, you know, center left types are perfectly fine with it. In fact, applaud it. So it's a safe thing for leaders to do. It does tend to happen more with, you know, as you would expect, with more authoritarian leaders like Netanyahu and Trump, as opposed to, you know, people who. People like, for example, Obama, but they do it too. So I would have to actually. I mean, I know what you mean about it. How it feels like this has been a big year for assassination. I'd actually have to. I would want to look. And I haven't done that, so I couldn't say one way or the other. But it is certainly. I would say what we do have here. I mean, there's different kinds of assassinations. I mean, doing assassinating, for example, Osama bin Laden was something that I think, you know, a lot of people, even people who generally oppose that sort of action, kind of got it, you know. And even al-Baghdadi, you know, I think people were a little bit more disposed to that sort of thing. But Qasem Soleimani and certainly Fakhrizadeh, these are things that are not seen as, I mean, some of the supporters may defend it as some sort of anti-terrorism or anti-aggression or something like that, some way of actually keeping a war at bay, but it's nonsense. And I think any reasonable person knows it's nonsense. And these are specifically targeted to cause conflict. So I think there's a very different and important aspect to these assassinations that you're referencing.
Yeah, I mean, it is remarkable. I was at the Yasser Arafat Museum in Ramallah a few years ago, and you go in that museum and they have a large display, beautiful museum, a large display highlighting all of the PLO members over the years that have been assassinated. And I, as an American, I mean, just stood there in shock because so many I didn't ever hear of or know about. I mean, it's plane crashes, it's poisoning, it's gun firing like we saw in Iran here with this recent assassination. I mean, it just goes again to just how blinded I think Americans, Michelle, are towards U.S. foreign policy around the world. If any of our people in this country were assassinated, and maybe it happens, but we just never know somehow in kind of a Jason Bourne dark mystery. But I'm pretty sure if any big time U.S. general or U.S. politician was killed by a foreign government here in the United States, imagine what our response would be. And then we have the Obama drone program and now Trump. Basically, these are like the foreign policy wins or assassinations now for this administration. And it's just always shocking to me what, again, the U.S. gets away with abroad, but we would never allow here at home towards our own people.
Well, yeah. And Mitchell, I want to ask you, I want to look at the sort of timeline of events this year in terms of the U.S. relationship with Iran and then ask you a sort of political question. But, you know, we have, as I mentioned, in January, we start off with the assassination of Soleimani, which was, as you say, a big deal. We have, like, 2 weeks later, a bunch of cables leaked from Pompeo to U.S. diplomats telling themselves to distance themselves from this militant, formerly designated a terrorist organization, the MEK, which, you know, is described as being cult-like and has no popularity within Iran, which seems really sort of like a deliberate leak to me. We have increasing sanctions on Iran as it tries to deal with COVID. We have these so-called peace deals between Israel and some Gulf states. And then we have this apparent assassination in August in Tehran. We have Mike Pompeo visiting settlements. We have this scientist now ambushed and killed. And so I think it could be tempting for people with very short memories to see this as a sort of lame duck spree by the Trump administration, or maybe by Netanyahu, as you know, before a friendly administration leaves office. But when you look back over the course of the year, it almost feels predictable. But I do want to ask you, if you look back over the course of what our relationship has been with Iran and Israel over this year, if this is sort of surprising, but not that surprising. And then also ask you, if Trump had won the 2020 election, do you think we would have seen this kind of assassination? Or is it like ultimately just to shoot Joe Biden in the foot as he comes into office?
I certainly think that, you know, the timeline that you're drawing is a very valid one and an important one. It's very clear to me that smarter people than Trump in this administration learned a really good lesson from Barack Obama, actually, because Obama did, you know, the Iran nuclear deal and more or less assumed that his successor would just sort of respect it. And at least, if not completely respect the spirit, at least respect the letter of the agreement, not pull out, as you saw many conservatives advising against pulling out of it. As they learned from that, and they said, well, we're going to make sure that our policy against Iran is something that's not so easily undone when we're out of office, whether that's 2020 or 2024. I do think that's exactly what they were thinking. And that sort of ties into your second question, which is in the sense that, do I think this necessarily would have happened now if Trump had won the election? Maybe not. I certainly do think Netanyahu has a sense of urgency about carrying out some more radical acts before Biden gets into office, because Biden would surely restrain reckless actions, and Biden's going to want to try and restore diplomacy. So he's going to press Israel to pull back. So I do think that you know, it happening, you know, right after Thanksgiving might be because of Trump leaving office. But clearly we know, because Netanyahu's threatened this in the past, we know this is something that Israel has wanted to do for some time. There's no reason to think the Trump administration would disapprove of it. And so I don't think it's something that would not have otherwise happened. In other words, I think it still would have happened if Trump won. It just might not have happened right now.
Might have waited till like after we have a COVID vaccine, maybe, or something else, not just try to jam it in under the wire.
I think in their minds, they might also have waited until their ridiculous and murderous, I would say, maximum pressure policy had taken more effect, or had softened Iran's stances, which of course is never going to happen. But I don't necessarily think the Trump administration planners realized that. So they might have thought that there might have been a better time in terms of their overall strategy for something like this. But then, you know, time ran out.
I also have to say, you know, when Biden comes into office, it's not just going to be, you know, whatever what Trump's done going against him and trying to somehow develop a more humane relationship with Iran. You have the likes of Tom Friedman in the Times today saying, no, it's not about Iran's supposed nuclear program. It's about their goals for the region and, you know, their other weapons programs. That's why we can't enter a new deal, a new kind of Iranian deal. So I have a feeling that the pressure on Biden to not go back to anything resembling the previous Iran deal, but to try to negotiate a deal that's a lot more onerous for Iran is going to be intense and going to come from all sides.
Well, I think we've seen that already. And actually, I saw the Friedman article, and I was actually quite thankful that he wrote it. I'm glad to see somebody, you know, the sort of pseudo-liberal Friedman coming out and saying, this isn't really about their nuclear program, because it's not. This can't possibly be about their nuclear program, because everything about the actions of the past 4 years has increased whatever danger there is of Iran actually trying to get a nuclear bomb. It's certainly given Iran more incentive to pursue one. So I was glad to see that he was saying that. And of course, this has been actually about trying to simply curtail Iran's regional influence from the beginning, an influence which incidentally was curtailed and it was hemmed in under Bill Clinton through the policy of dual containment, containing both Iran and Iraq and kind of playing them off against each other so neither one of them could get too influential in the region. We can talk about the damage that policy did, and it's important to do that. It's not a great policy, but just in terms of deterring the regional influence of either one of those countries, it did work. And then that was blown to smithereens by the George W. Bush invasion of Iraq. And this has been the response from the right wing side has been to try and really smother Iran or strangle Iran might be the better metaphor there ever since that fateful policy decision of invading Iraq. So, you know, this is just more of the same. And again, I'm glad that Friedman is admitting it, because this is about, about the fact that because Iran is not on our side, it's not on Israel's side, it's not on Saudi Arabia's side, it does not have the right that every other country normally has to its own self-defense, to its own military. I mean, you know, I'd love to see the whole world face these kinds of military restrictions, but it's not good when it's only one country being singled out for political reasons.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk now about Jared Kushner just happening to be in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, supposedly for talks to try to mend this years-long rift within the Gulf Cooperation Council about Qatar funding terrorism. This trip happens to come also just on the heels of Netanyahu and Mike Pompeo supposedly meeting with the Saudi crown prince. Although the last I saw, Saudi Arabia had said, no, that Netanyahu wasn't there. So I'm not sure if they have now confirmed it or if we're all just assuming it happened, even though they're denying it. So if they are indeed trying to coax the Saudis into some kind of public deal with Israel, how do you think this assassination affects that effort?
So, yes, the Saudis are denying that meeting ever happened, but we know it happened. It's not, I would just say, it's not an assumption. We know from flight tracking websites that saw the planes carrying Netanyahu and Pompeo and their parties going into Saudi Arabia. So we know they met. We know that meeting happened. More than likely, this assassination was discussed there. But it, again, part of, I think, the Trump administration's attempts to solidify an anti-Iran bloc, a key component of that is mending this rift in the Gulf Cooperation Council. I think it's important for us to remember this rift happened literally because of Donald Trump, because Trump came into office, had no idea of the politics of the region. The Saudis spoke to him and said the Qataris are funding terrorism. They're terrorists. They're bad people. And Trump gave the green light for all of this to happen and then realized that he had made a mistake, that this was not actually good for the sort of anti-Iran bloc that he hoped to build. And he's been trying to fix it pretty much ever since. I mean, it took about a year for him to realize the mistake he made. But since then, they've been trying to mend this rift. And it's very difficult because the blockade isn't really damaging Qatar that much. Not as much as you would think a blockade would when you look at blockades in other places. If you think of some place like Gaza, it has nothing like those kind of effects. It's mostly been a hassle for other countries that have to fly around Qatari airspace and you know, things like that. So there isn't a ton of incentive for Qatar to give any concessions. And without concessions, the Saudis back, the Saudis and the other countries that are, you know, UAE, Bahrain, and Egypt that are part of that blockade are, you know, faced with the proposition of losing face and, you know, backing down without getting anything that they were trying to get from Qatar. But at the same time, the Trump administration, and particularly also the Israelis, want this rift healed so they can put together this anti-Iran Gulf bloc backed by the United States and Israel. That would be a really formidable opponent for Iran. And if they can bring in countries like Qatar and Oman, which have relatively good relationships with Iran, really would it really would isolate Iran in a much more severe way. I don't know that that's necessarily possible, but that is their hope. So, but I do think it's important to, because it seems like certainly in the mainstream media, it seems to just have been forgotten that this was a mess largely of Donald Trump's making.
Yeah, I mean, it has been. I had to go back and check myself how long ago that was and whether it had been resolved or not, because there's just nothing about it. It was like it was in the news for a couple of weeks in 2017 when it started, and then there's just been absolutely nothing ever since. So, yeah, I mean, I don't. Do you have any hopes that Kushner, Jared Kushner, the man with the plan, is going to be able to effect this this reconciliation?
It's not going to be Kushner. You know, just as it was, if you noticed, when Kushner was doing all this back and forth with the UAE and Bahrain, trying to get them together with Israel, it was kind of stalling and not going in with him. Pompeo, who for all his just horribleness, is not the complete incompetent that Jared Kushner is, which only, of course, makes it more dangerous. But he got involved and managed, you know, he understands what, you know, how you can bring these things together, how you can leverage the various needs and interests and find a way to, you know, to get to where you want to go. I think that Kushner is not going to be able to heal this. I don't think Pompeo or anyone in the Trump administration is going to be able to either. I'm not sure that anyone really can. It's going to really be up to the Saudis and the Emiratis to find a way to back down gracefully, because they're not going to get what they want from Qatar. Qatar has for a very long time, you know, been this sort of, you know, this country that one person once told me, a former ambassador to the region told me that they'd love to punch above their weight, and they're really good at it. You know, by backing groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, they have a lot more popular appeal in the region. So that's a tool that they use. Obviously, Al Jazeera is another big tool that they use, and that's one of the major irritants to the Saudis. So, you know, there's no real reason for them to give that up. They're doing very well on the whole. So, yeah, the Saudis are going to have to figure out how to back that. And eventually, I think they will find a way to do it. But I don't think it's going to be through American efforts.
I want to go back to Mike Pompeo, because I agree with you. I think that, you know, Pompeo, as odious as he is, has been pretty effective, I think, and got in terms of getting what he wants, right? Because this does seem to be, you know, part of his personal mission. And one of the other things that he did recently, you know, to bring it sort of domestically again, is a move officially at the State Department to explicitly classify support for BDS, or I think for any kind of boycott of Israel or its settlements, as anti-Semitic. And so I want to talk about these moves at home, these sort of softer moves, and how they shape our attitudes and our discourse toward Israel, but also toward Iran, because I do want to point out, you know, and we have been doing this throughout this conversation, but I think it is actually, it is pretty nauseating that we are at this point where we talk about, you know, the targeted killing of a human being who presumably had a family and, had a career and, had everything that goes into making up a life. And we just have to talk about them in terms of sort of geopolitical poker all the time and the way the chips are going to fall as a result of them, you know, being like machine gunned in their car. These are sort of two separate issues, but it's like a continued dehumanization of whoever our enemy is. And then these sort of softer trying to control the message here at home. So, yeah, I wonder if you could talk about the impact of these less dramatic actions.
Yeah, kind of funny because, you know, the question of BDS and labeling it as anti-Semitic is something that I take very personally. I'm not active in the BDS movement, but I am very active in promoting the idea that Palestinians are entitled and justified in calling for BDS. That is up to them. And we, people who consider themselves even moderately liberal should be applauding that sort of tactic. So this effort to label it anti-Semitic, I think is very insidious. As a Jew, it's offensive to me. Someone who's actually faced real anti-Semitism, this made-up version it minimizes what I've gone through and what people, you know, the far worse that other Jews have gone through. So it's offensive on that level. But, you know, it really effectively silences people. And it's because who wants to be called an anti-Semite? Most people don't like that. So, and it's completely unjustified. The idea that Israel cannot be criticized, that Israel can't be boycotted. One of the things, I wrote a piece on this very recently. People can find it at rethinkingforeignpolicy.org. The issue is that you can oppose BDS. I think it's perfectly legitimate as a matter of political debate that you think BDS is wrong. You think Israel doesn't deserve to be boycotted. Fine, make that case. Make the case. Tell me why Israel should not be boycotted or should be immune from boycott. Make that case. Don't tell me that anyone who disagrees with you is by definition an anti-Semite. So it cheapens the whole discourse and it further alienates Palestinians. As a matter of fact, I just put a new blog piece up right before this show talking about how Pompeo had said that the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan, in making their normalization agreements with Israel, had recognized Israel as the rightful homeland of the Jewish people, which is just an outright lie. They recognized no such thing. I went back and checked the text of all the agreements. They recognized no such thing. They recognized Israel's sovereignty, which you have to do to normalize relations. But nobody has ever been asked to recognize Israel as the homeland of the Jewish people or as a Jewish state, except for the Palestinians. So all of this is about delegitimizing the Palestinian cause. In the same way, I was criticized by a number of right-wingers for calling the attack on Fatah in Iran terrorism, because it was an attack meant to cause a political change. That was, which I said, that's the very definition of terrorism. And people just thought that was absurd. They didn't say why, but the implication is because he's Iranian. That somehow, because he's Iranian, it's perfectly legitimate to kill him. That being Iranian, just like being Palestinian, dehumanizes you, as you framed it, I think correctly, dehumanizes you to such an extent that it's a perfectly legitimate thing to just take your life. I think that's we see that in both cases. I think you're right in saying it's not only it dehumanizes us, it dehumanizes our discourse and the way we see other people. And it also makes it much harder to come to rational policy, even if you just want to look at it from a cold, strategic point of view. Just it removes the ability to think rationally about our policy.
Yeah, I totally agree. You can't. It's hard to go back and forth between these. All of these people are disposable, and you know we must do what we need to do. It's imperative that we make this deal with our neighbors for the greater good. You know, it like those two viewpoints can't really coexist. Michelle Plitnik, political analyst, writer, and president of Rethinking Foreign Policy. Thank you so much, as always, for your time. And tell our listeners one more time where they should go to find more of your work.
You can find my work at rethinkingforeignpolicy.org. And I will also be having a book come out in February, co-authored with Mark Lamont Hill, called Except for Palestine. You can pre-order that at bookshop.org.
All right. You heard it here, Misfits. And of course, you heard him on Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik. We're live in D.C., and we'll be back right after this. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, where we bring you news, politics, and culture without the red and blue treatment, but sometimes with a lot of yelling. I'm Michelle Witte. I'm here with Bob Schlehuber. It's Monday. It's 1:30. And that means it's time for Miss the Press. And Bob, it's also time for something a little different, because I'm not that mad about the clips I'm starting with. I mean, of course, I am mad, let me be clear, but I am not mad at the host at this moment, although I will be angry with her later. And so this is a little bit unusual for this segment, because usually we're trying to show up these hosts doing a bad job. But actually, I just wanted to talk about the hunger and eviction crisis we are facing in this country. And they happen to be talking about it on Face the Nation this morning. So Margaret Brennan, who hosts that show, I am not angry at you yet, specifically. I am, however, very angry at all the forces that have brought us to this moment. Margaret Brennan spoke with CEO of Feeding America, Claire Babineau-Fontenot, a name I forgot to look up how to pronounce, but I'm pretty sure that's it.
No, that was nailed it.
And I got to say, Claire, I know you are feeding. She's feeding America, but she is really hogging every syllable. And some of us with short names need some of those syllables. Anyway, they talked about the demand that Feeding America is seeing at their food banks and the gulf between the assistance our government is providing for people and the actual need. So let's hear Claire Babineau-Fontenot talk about how what we are getting is not sufficient.
The typical payment, according to the USDA, is for a family of four to get $680 to last for a month. According to your organization, a third of the customers you are seeing at your food banks don't even qualify for food stamps. What does that suggest to you about how out of line the states and the federal government is with the absolute need you're seeing on the front lines?
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you started there, because that's one of the solutions. That's something we could do right now that could help families that are struggling. So not only do we have many people who turn to us for help, or people who don't qualify, but barely don't qualify under current guidelines, but we also have a number of people who turn to us for help who qualify, but what they receive does not satisfy their needs for their families because of things like what you said. I want to throw out one more statistic, if you don't mind, which is that the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics just said that grocery prices right now are at a 50-year high.
Bob, we have been tracking this for months, right? Talking about how unrealistic our poverty thresholds are, talking about how difficult it's been for people to get the assistance that is on offer. And of course, now we hear from someone who is apparently, you know, on the front lines that even that assistance often isn't enough without that extra federal bonus from the CARES Act that helped lift people out of poverty over the summer, but of course expired a couple months ago. And so I just want to ask again, we've gone months and months without any new assistance packages for people. We have watched eviction moratoria end. We are seeing long lines at food banks across the country. And we are seeing that the assistance on offer is not even adequate for some families. And so yet again, why all this focus on individuals behaving badly as the reason this virus is continuing to spread unchecked through our communities? I think it is a cover for malpractice by our government, Bob.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to be poor. I think people will look past that. It's hard to get on these government benefit programs. It's not that easy just to go in there and corrupt and steal all the money like some people want you to believe, but it's difficult. And you have people barely getting enough to feed their families. And then whatever left they have, they can sometimes sell it or try to get additional money to provide for transportation, healthcare, education costs, which we've seen skyrocket because people all of a sudden have to learn in new environments at home and have to have their own equipment. I mean, it's just a struggle for people during this pandemic. And yeah, I mean, to see corporate supermarkets jack the prices up in a moment like this is absolutely disgusting. Obviously, there's more stresses on the system, which costs more money. But at the end of the day, with these food stamp programs, it ends up just essentially being another way for corporations to rob the government, because they're saying to the government, sure, I'm glad you're giving that money to people, but we're not going to increase the cost of our goods that people can purchase with that increase in our bottom profit. So they know more money's in the economy right now to spend on food, unlike maybe services or when it comes to travel. So there's additional money in the economy to be spent by some people. So increase those prices, Michelle. It just shows how corporations in this country do not care about the people it serves.
Nope, they don't. And I've got a little bit more of this conversation from Face the Nation, Bob. And I'm getting a little mad here at Margaret Brennan. This is the theme. I get increasingly angry at her as these clips go on. So this is further on in their conversation. They're talking about whether food banks are prepared for a surge in demand. And let's hear, I want to point out how they frame this discussion in this next clip.
The CARES Act, a lot of its support to Americans runs out at the end of December, leaving potentially almost 7 million people pending eviction, 12 million Americans without unemployment benefits. What is that going to do? Are your food banks prepared to meet what is potentially a lot of new need?
Well, I'll tell you, I'll bet on this network of remarkable people to do everything that they can all the time. But the simple truth is, there's no way that the charitable food system can do this alone. It's going to require, it's an all-in fight. It's going to require policy interventions, regulatory interventions. It's also public-private partnerships. I think we've got to get really serious about doing something about this, because in our country, we actually have the resources and the ingenuity that's necessary to really solve these problems, as nuanced and complex as they are.
Yeah, I got a problem with this, Bob. I mean, one, of course, we should all be angry about these numbers. We should be angry about 7 million people facing eviction. We should be angry about 12 million people losing their unemployment benefits. We should be angry about food prices rising. But also, I think we need to pay attention to the structure of this whole conversation, because this disaster is being framed as a fight against some kind of natural disaster. And while the virus is indeed a natural disaster, this wave of hunger in the United States is definitely not. This is absolutely a man-made crisis that was made by everybody in this government who was not able to put together another relief package. It was made by the decision to reopen businesses. It was made by the decision to make our healthcare system for profit and tied to employment. And it is being fueled by everyone who is fighting to keep things that way. That is why hunger and homelessness are poised to explode across this country. And so I resent this framing. It is an all-in fight, as the Feeding America CEO put it. But this fight is against this kind of government and against these kinds of decisions. It's not us united against hunger, because the hunger is not inevitable, right? So it has to be us against the people who create these scenarios and then act powerless to stop them. So all these, like, oh, we got to have an intervention into a situation that they absolutely created. And I also want to point out, before I let this go, Bob, that new research from the Institute of Policy Studies shows that U.S. billionaires have gotten 34% richer since March of this year, growing their wealth by $1 trillion. There are 650 U.S. billionaires right now, Bob, 650 too many. And 29 of them have doubled their wealth during the course of this pandemic. And I can tell you, they are having no trouble at all finding food, because there is no shortage of food and there is no shortage of housing. There is no shortage of money. What we are apparently short on is political imagination, political will, morality, and character. And at the end of writing all of that, I would be really ashamed to be an American if I didn't also all day long see people running around trying to help themselves, trying to help their communities, trying to help people they don't know. So I am not ashamed of, you know, those people, my fellow countrymen, and the situation we find ourselves in. I'll just say, you know, we should stay mad at the relative handful of people who are profiting from all this suffering and stay proud of the folks working against it. And, you know, I have some questions for the likes of Margaret Brennan for not finding time to bring up this contrast and to say, you know, hey, is this really a fight against a famine, some kind of natural disaster, or is it a fight against a political system that has been in place for decades?
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable here in Washington, D.C. I do really enjoy local D.C. politics for God knows whatever reason, Michelle. But going to the forums over all of the years for the different political campaigns, you have every single politician in the city talking about the need to address the affordable housing crisis. And you kind of look around at the end and you're like, well, why do we have a crisis and who's behind it? But they're always talking about, oh, we just need to build more houses and we need to do this program and that program and that will relieve things. But then you actually go look at who is funding these politicians' campaigns, and it's like developers and real estate officials in the economy. Muriel Bowser, the mayor of this city, along with 11 of the 13 council members, number one donors are real estate and developers. And so when you talk about needing to work with the government to address affordable housing crisis. You're saying, are we going to work with the developers that have created the housing crisis to solve the crisis? And you're like, well, wait, of course not. Of course, these people aren't going to work with us to solve the crisis they themselves have either created or they themselves as politicians have supported by taking that money. And so when you look at an issue like food insecurity, it's the same thing. Are we reliant on the people that are in office because they were able to raise the most amount of money from billionaires to then help us support the people with the least money amongst? No, that's crazy. That just does not add up whatsoever. But time and again, we're just fooled and hoodwinked because of our media and the way in which politicians work in this country. We genuinely believe them, Michelle, when they say they want to address these issues. And I guess that's what I always struggle with, is because they're looking you right in the eye and saying, yes, we want to address housing. Yes, we want to address hunger. But obviously, they're not able to do so either because of their ideology not aligning with it, or those who put them in office do not want those things solved.
Yeah. Well, Bob, sorry, it doesn't end there. We got to take this to a global level. And this is when we're both really going to get apoplectic, because Margaret Brennan continued talking about hunger, this time on a global scale, talking about the potential for widespread famine with UN Food Program Executive Director David Beasley, who told her 270 million people around the world are on the precipice of starvation, and about half of that is due to the pandemic. But of course, a lot of it is due to man-made conflicts compounded with climate change and fragile governments. And you know, Bob, when I heard conflict, fragile governments, and climate change, you know, my sense that the U.S. might be involved somehow started tingling. And so then Brennan said, okay, well, name some parts of the world that are of particular concern. And he says, Yemen, Syria, South Sudan, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. And of course, Bob, you know, I'm starting to think, all right, well, my hunch was right. Maybe Face the Nation is going to allude to this in some way and say, huh, you know, should the U.S. bear some responsibility for this hunger? Let's see if that's a question Margaret Brennan asked, Bob. Let's hear her ask David Beasley.
Well, it's extremely important. That's one of the things I'm talking with leaders around the world, especially the United States, who is our number one donor, as well as European leaders. You know, when you go back to the Syrian war.
Bob, that was the wrong clip. Unfortunately, you didn't get to hear Margaret Brennan say, hey, David Beasley, the U.S. is really hurting right now. And we know U.S. taxpayers are the biggest funders of the World Food Program. So should we expect them to continue to kick in? And it's like, my God. I mean, Bob, I have some figures for you here. The U.S. gave $3.4 billion last year to the World Food Program, and we are nearing $3 billion this year, which does sound like a lot until you contrast that with the U.S. defense discretionary budget last year, which was more than $686 billion. And so, again, we are talking about hunger caused by conflict, and we don't ask about the U.S. role in starting those conflicts. Instead, we just ask, how are we going to pay for it this year when we have hungry people at home? And so I just would like to leave you with this, Bob. You might not know, David Beasley is an American Republican and the former governor of South Carolina. And so perhaps we should not be surprised that he thinks everything the United States is doing just fine, and it is perfectly acceptable to, you know, with one hand, stir the pot, fuel these conflicts that create so much hunger, and on the other hand, you know, act like the martyr and savior of the world for donating a pittance to then try and absolve some of that.
Yeah, we do have a caller here with us. I believe the caller is here. Samuel. Samuel, are you with us?
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good, man. Thanks for calling in. We really appreciate it. What's on your mind today?
Well, I just really appreciate it. I was listening to your earlier conversation, and I thought I'd missed my chance to bring up what I was kind of thinking about. Luckily, you guys started talking about one of my favorite topics, which is the, you know, the corporate media and how it's just never going to be the place to hash out these kind of issues, especially, you know, Sunday morning talk shows. And I was just, you know, when it comes to either having it be an international issue or, you know, a local issue of hunger or, you know, starvation, poverty, and how that's kind of like some of the basic needs that we have. It really made me think, like, where are the socialists? Where are they at? You know, they're online, they're on, you know, talk shows like this and, you know, places like that. But where are the socialists with flags and shirts and hats and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it seems super basic, but just like outside, like yelling about international solidarity and Palestine and food and hunger and economic policy and actions that we can take on a day-to-day basis. Where is the place for that to be happening on the streets of the United States in 2020?
Yeah, Samuel, thank you so much for the call. Michelle, I'm happy to go, or you can jump in and respond first.
I mean, I would say that they are out there. I think their numbers are small. It would be silly to try to overstate them, but I do think those numbers are growing. I think you don't see them because, you know, they're not covered, right? And so we try to do that. Bob, we try to highlight those movements on this show. And that's what I mean when I'm talking about people who are out there trying to work for each other. But you don't see them highlighted on mainstream media, because I think then you'd have to talk about something other than representation. You'd have to actually talk about ideology, and you'd have to, you know, ask some questions that obviously they don't want to ask.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then you have neoliberal Democrats that we just talked about at the top of the show at the communications and economic teams working aggressively to silence people on the left and to silence socialists. And I say left because the Democratic Party is a center-right party in the United States. They're not a leftist party. They maybe in contrast to the Republicans are to the left of the Republicans, but there's people working against those powers. I think the other big problem is that there's just no foothold for socialism in this country. We've seen groups like the DSA and PSL grow over the last several years, but there's not a deep history of large institutional building. I think that's the struggle too. We've seen a lot of social protests, civil protests, but a lot of those protest leaders over the years have been co-opted and moved away from building the deeper institutional roots that socialism needs to really thrive in this country. Michelle, we're running out of time. I got one last clip here. We can't get out of Miss the Press without playing a Chuck Todd clip from Meet the Press. In this clip, Todd is interviewing Admiral Mike Mullen. And in the interview, Todd is complaining about how the Trump administration is boxing in the Biden administration in regards to Iran and foreign policy. Todd talks about how in 2008, Bush and Obama worked seamlessly. They kind of hugged each other in their transition, Michelle. That's how he remembers it, at least. Have a listen to Todd worry about what the world must be thinking about this boxing in of the Biden administration by Trump.
This was a transition, and granted, made easier because Gates was staying over, where there was consultation and there was a concern, what would the world think if one president boxed in another president? Now we have one American president boxing in another American president. What message does that send to the world, Admiral Mullen?
I mean, just two quick points, Michelle. One, boxed in. Every president does not care about their predecessor in coming in and boxing them in. Barack Obama did not mind signing the JCPOA in the last year of his 8-year administration, boxing in Donald Trump on Iran and the nuclear agreement. Trump moved away from it, but he was quote unquote boxed in. And if anything, Barack Obama and his administration boxed Donald Trump in on Russia by framing it, and this is Clinton as well, framing it as if Donald Trump was some Manchurian candidate of the Russians. He boxed in. The only conversation we had for 4 years because of liberals boxing in on Donald Trump was about Russiagate. So Chuck Todd, what in the world are you talking about? What a dumb statement. And is America really surprised at anything Donald Trump is doing? Like, are we really still people abroad, Michelle, still looking at America like, I still haven't made up my mind. Oh, but this boxing in thing. Oh, my God. What absurd creatures there in the United States. Like, stop, Chuck Todd. You've done too much. Michelle, we've done too much here. We've gone over our time in our weekly Miss the Press segment. Let's take one final break. That was our weekly Miss the Press segment. And as always,
you, Chuck Todd.
Welcome back to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, where we bring you news, politics, and culture without the red and blue treatment. I'm Michelle Witte, still here with Bob Schlehuber, and a couple of workplace-related stories to close the show on, if you like volcanoes and football in your place of work. Remember earlier today when we were talking about other countries having much younger and more diverse leadership? So the country that I was thinking of, in contrast, was New Zealand with Jacinda Ardern as prime minister, who is, I think, one of the youngest world leaders right now. And, you know, not a perfect person, but certainly a lot better than our government here, and manages to be young and a woman and do things. So Maybe a heads up to all the people who think that only old white guys can run countries. Anyway, you might have remembered that a volcano erupted in New Zealand in December of last year, and a workplace watchdog on Monday, that's today, announced charges against people it says were responsible for the deaths of 22 people who were taken to these islands where the volcano erupted, despite the fact that that volcano had been at a high alert. The alert level regarding that volcano had been changed like 3 weeks before. So the regulator investigated this and was like, why are you all taking tour groups to this island when, you know, there's a volcano that might erupt? And it did, in fact, erupt. It killed 22 people, left another more than a dozen people seriously injured from burning ash and steam. And so it looks like New Zealand is going to take that seriously and say, you know, accidents happen, but this could have been prevented. And it seems pretty dumb to be ferrying tourists around a volcano that's maybe going to explode at any second. So I support that. And also, Bob, and some people who probably need more workplace action, the NFL, which has had a very weird week. You know, we had Denver trying to play without an actual quarterback, which turns out is not recommended. And now you have this Ravens-Steelers game, which has been postponed twice, and which is, I guess, still a go, although the Ravens practice today has been canceled. But what I learned this week, Bob, was that if a team has to forfeit a game due to COVID, the players are not going to get paid. And this, for me, is like a perfect microcosm of everything that is wrong with our COVID response, right? You have to go to work. You have to continue making money for your bosses, in this case, for team owners, and for everyone who is making millions and billions to the fractions that you are getting for your own risk. And yet, if there is a COVID breakout, that's your loss, buddy. So unbelievable, Bob. Unbelievable that you would say, oh, if you have to forfeit a game, none of the players get paid for their work and their risk.
Yeah. And some of these players, too, it's like they're not the ones that have COVID or are part of the outbreak. And so if you're just kind of like following the rules on your own team or your own business, you are punished for the lack of oversight by your business. And so it's absolutely absurd. There, Michelle, man, yeah, I almost tuned into that Denver game. First game I would have watched in 4 years just to see what it was like for an NFL team to play without a quarterback. Pretty absurd that the sport's still going. And seeing the 49ers will have to play their next two home games in Arizona because Santa Clara County has canceled all mass gatherings and sporting events, but yet somehow the NFL continues on. Michelle, we got to take a break here for today. We'll be back with a brand new episode of Political Misfits tomorrow at 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Big thanks to all of our guests today, Mitchell Plitnick, Kay Pritzker, John Jeter, Marchette DeMissi, and Professor Hakeem Adi. Big thank you, as always, to Ryan, Dimitri, Andre, and Saul, and the entire Sputnik News team. On behalf of Michelle Witte and myself, Bob Schlehuber, thank you for listening. Now get back to organizing.